After seeing the grave close over the mortal remains of a supposed Francis Bacon, he made his way to Germany, and there reactivated the Rosicrucian Order. Later he continued this type of work throughout Europe, consolidating groups of disciples and pouring the vital life of the Spirit into weary hearts. Years later Francis Bacon made his ascension from the Rákóczi Sisal in Transylvania, the former home of the great Prince Rákóczi, who is now the ascended being known as the Divine Director. Prince Rákóczi was for centuries the teacher assigned to Francis Bacon, during that and many previous embodiments. So close was their association and understanding that teacher and Keel emerged in the minds of the public, and to this day Francis Bacon is often referred to as the Master Rákóczi. He is, however, correctly identified as the ascended Master Saint Germain, for he himself selected the title of Sanctus Germanus or Holy Brother. For many years he has served as Chuan of the Seventh Ray, taking over that post from the beloved historical figure of ancient China, the ascended Lady Master Kuan Yin. Although Saint Germain still retains his Chuanship, he was recently crowned as Lord of Civilization for the Aquarian Cycle. In Foundations Unearthed, Maria Bauer tells the inspiring story of the discovery of the vault containing Bacon's original papers. It still lies buried in Bruton Churchyard at Williamsburg, Virginia, where it was placed over 300 years ago by command of Bacon himself. The vault contains papers which reveal the divine plan for the Aquarian Age, and other valuable documents relating to the destiny of America. 3 centuries ago Francis Bacon preserved and for safety concealed this most treasured heritage of all times, for it is destined to serve as a guidepost for the American people in their hour of greatest spiritual hunger. Hiding behind the cloak of church unity, vested money interests have thus far prevented the actual opening of the vault, depriving humanity of its rightful heritage which is so sorely needed now. Bacon predicted that the vault would be opened when God, speaking through the voice of the people, would lead them to cry out against their overlords, demanding the buried treasure. Foundations Unearthed is now out of print, but it is worth borrowing if you can search it out. However, sometime in 1959, another book by Maria Bauer will be published, and it will incorporate all of the material presented in this first little volume. The new book will be much longer and much more thrilling, for it will cover 2 main themes. The birth of a new age and quest for Bruton Vault. The full manuscript is as yet untitled. Besant, Annie Theosophical Publishing Co., Wheaton, Ill. The Self and Its Sheaths, a guidebook for students who wish to take a backward glance through the early days of the Theosophical movement, founded by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky at the behest of the hierarchy. Although the turbulence and fiery zeal demonstrated by those pioneers in humanity's upliftment to the light, have no place in the calm and measured discipleship through which light consumes the dark news of today, it is nevertheless stimulating to look in on these embattled servers at work. Annie Besant, in a previous embodiment of historical moment, was the martyr Giordano Bruno, who was burned at the stake in the year of 1600. By orders of Church Unity's inquisitorial court, which pronounced him a confirmed heretic. During that embodiment, Bruno departed from his enforced role as a Dominican monk and wandered over Europe and England as an itinerant scholar. He contacted Francis Bacon and many of Bacon's closest disciples and co-workers. Recently Bruno again emerged in characterization, although slightly disguised, in the literary marts of the land. He was selected by author James Joyce for a special role in Finnegan's Wake, that of Mr. Brown, a member of the firm of Brown and Nolan, and again as Bruno Nolan. In consciousness, Annie Besant continued the path of high evolvement which she set as Bruno. All of her books, and they are many, make splendid reading, even though our Aquarian Age disciples will not have to battle the turbulent sea of hostility encountered by the stormy petrels of the Piscean days. That good fight was fought by the valiant ones like Bruno and Annie Besant. Balvatsky, Helena Petrovna Theosophical Publishing Co., Wheaton, Ill. The Secret Doctrine, Adior Edition Isis Unveiled, In the Outer World of Discipleship, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky has been aptly compared with the Rock of Gibraltar. she can only be described as one of nature's mighty wonders. In this last embodiment she emerged, or perhaps it might be better said that she escaped, out of Russia and into the world. It was not that any Blavatsky was unwelcome in the old Russia of the last century. Quite the contrary, Russia simply did not offer sufficient opportunities, amid its corruption and barbarism, for the impetuous Helena to serve the Christ forces openly and freely. She felt cramped and awkward in that wasteland of frozen evil, where even the very earth was tainted by the satanic forces which had made it a focus of darkness in ancient Lemurian times. The entire globe became her abiding place physically, intellectually and spiritually. She roamed the far-flung reaches of the universe. For long centuries, in embodiment after embodiment, she served the forces of light. In all history there have probably been few disciples who have enjoyed such a close working relationship with ascended masters and cosmic adepts. Madame Blavatsky was always the general in command of outer world strategy. She knew what support the Christ forces needed for their outer world program, and she never failed to measure up to their need. Madame Blavatsky was the first tentative public relations agent appointed to serve as a bridge between the hierarchy and the outer world. The masters, even in those years of the last century, were already preparing for the vast public program being directed today by Saint Germain. Ascended Master Jewel Kull handles outer world public relations for the hierarchy, and today he works through a large staff of disciples who are employed in various jobs in the outer world. Most of them are trained writers, lecturers, teachers, artists, actors, or theater craftsmen, and many of them are not aware that they are overshadowed by the Christ forces. But in the days of Madame Blavatsky this present streamlined setup did not exist. The masters were just getting the program organized, and Madame Blavatsky was the girl Friday who handled the hundreds of outer world office details. She was the ideal type for the job because all barriers, human as well as inhuman, removed themselves in the face of her executive advance. Naturally, in a public relations role, she had many dealings with printers. She was not exactly unreasonable, she was merely unyielding in her demands that this must be finished at once for the boss, or in a tone of hushed confidence she would say, "The boss wants us to do our very, very best on this work, and by the way, he was immensely pleased with your last printing job." The harassed printers, bored by the endless daily grind, would respond to her import-laden words as a dry sponge responds to water. Thus refreshed, they would return merrily to their typesetting, but only after making solicitous inquiries about the well-being of the boss, and complimenting Madame Blavatsky on her good fortune in working for an employer who was obviously most generously endowed with every known virtue. The printers little realized that truth pressed close upon them. The famous document known as the Secret Doctrine is encyclopediac like Madame Blavatsky herself. Most of it was dictated to her while she was residing in England. Portions of it were supplied by various adepts, including four Achuins and the ascended Master Jewel Kull. However, Madame Blavatsky did not hesitate to add her own findings, her own deductions, if she felt that a bit of her own forthright spirit would help to make truth more refreshing to the public. She drew freely on her own experiences as a lesser initiate, and on her personal visits with many adepts, especially in India and Tibet. In summation, her work is brave and clear, and for many years to come it will be required reading for every disciple. It may not provide much light on the particular path which modern disciples will follow under the new Aquarian dispensation. But even the most astute sometimes find an encyclopedia indispensable, and Madame Blavatsky provided, through her writings, a complete index to human evolution as it was understood in the Piscean cycle. Bulwer Lytton Farrer, Strauss and Kudely, Incorporated, New York, Zanoni. Zanoni is a book which should be read by every aspirant who feels the compelling urge to ask that needless question, "What can I do personally to help the forces of light?" This book is classed as fiction, but that is only an editor's way of saying that he does not have the courage to speak the truth. Bulwer Lytton has set forth facts as experienced by himself or other disciples who were his friends. As an established author, he served the Christ forces by writing this book. disguised as fiction, it was widely received, and is still much read and much discussed. It would be reintroduced to the young people of today, for despite its vintage it is still wholly enchanting. Carr, Otis T. Millennium Publications, 2502 North Calvert Street, Baltimore 18, Maryland, Dimensions of Mystery, an heretofore unpublished document of scientific symbolism, revelatory of significant technological fundamentals for the Aquarian Age. Dimensions of Mystery offers an entirely new literary approach. It does not fall into any classification set up by Piscean Age editors. It definitely belongs in a free orbit where profundity of spirit can mingle socially with an insouciant charm. Otis T. Carr is a temple degree frater of the Rosicrucian Order, whose cosmic illumination stems from the first personalities of this recorded age, Amenhotep IV and the beautiful Queen Nefertiti. This manuscript, which was written and first calligraphed by the hand of Otis T. Carr in 1952, has been previously restrained from public view pending the currently evolving readiness of observers to perceive the esoteric enlightenment that signifies a general preparation for transition into the new millennium. This manuscript, which was written and first calligraphed by the hand of Otis T. Carr in 1952, has been previously restrained from public view pending the currently evolving readiness of observers to perceive the esoteric enlightenment that signifies a general preparation for transition into the new millennium. Dimensions of Mystery is an allegorical treatise of both historical and mystical aspect, which until now has been exposed to only 7 persons in 7 years. Dimensions is an inspired testament to the true heritage of mankind as graven in the everlasting stone of the Great Pyramid of Gizeh, and in the other 6 temples of posterity. It makes delightful reading for everyone, but will be of especial significance to all true mystics, adepts, and other Illuminati. Elsom, John R. Medor Publishing Company, Boston, Mass., Lightning Over the Treasury Building, Fraser, Felix J. and Elsa Peters Morse New Age Publishing Co., 15542 Glendale Boulevard, Los Angeles 26, California, Tomorrow's Money, George, Henry George School of Social Science, 50 East 69 Street, New York, NY, Progress and Poverty. Here are 3 books, listed above, which will provide neophyte armchair economists with a feast beyond compare. However, with the possible exception of Progress and Poverty, they are already as outmoded as the dinosaur so far as Aquarian Age disciples are concerned. Money as we know it in this year of 1958 is in the museum piece stage on the Inner Plains. The black magicians and their teeming hordes of tools have held money completely captive for millions of years, irrespective of whether money was represented by gold, wampum or slaves from Africa. Now all black magicians have been removed from the planet and cannot return. This is a hierarchical decision and irrevocable. The only remaining tools are those till in embodiment, and every minute of every hour of every day, their own discordant creations are closing more tightly around them. All tools, even the unwitting servers of darkness and ignorance, will destroy themselves during their present embodiment. And the rapidity of their self-destruction is being speeded up daily by the inflow of cosmic light. This cosmic light, beamed upon the Earth and its inhabitants from the heart of the great central sun, causes extremely rapid fulfillment of the law of the circle which governs all life in the universe. Under the old order, a crotchety individual could indulge for entire lifetimes in temper tantrums, emotional orgies, anger, hate, greed or lust, or any type of violence including murder. He could cycle in and out of embodiment time after time, and repeat all of his mistakes over and over again. Under the law of the circle, his poison thought forms would travel to the periphery of the global atmosphere and back again before striking their fangs into him. Often he would be out of embodiment before the discord which he sowed returned. Of course his karma would be sitting there waiting for him when he did come back into embodiment, but by the time he was off on another destructive course of living, and it was mentally impossible for him to tie in present effects with causes which he had rooted in past centuries. In order to rationalize these constantly recurring situations, millions of people turned to the easy way of blasphemy. They either profaned God because of their misfortunes or, if they were the more sanctimonious type, they raised their pious eyes to the ceiling cobwebs and spoke disconsolately of God's will. Official churchianity applauded loudly, because so long as their contributors shunted God out to the left field, there was a greater demand for on-the-spot services of professional prayer-mongers. For a small fee these agile performers could take the twinges out of the hinges of consciences that were creaking across the land like rusty gates. Under their self-appointed power role, these paid professionals could officially forgive profanity and blasphemy, but they could not explain the hidden cause of such actions. They solved the problem by officially upholding as divine and insoluble all vagaries of a lucky or unlucky pattern of living, the outcome of which was more uncertain than a spinning roulette wheel. From time to time, rumors that had to do with karma drifted through from the mysterious east. Outraged churchianity took care of that subject in a hurry, and in a way intended to make the listening sinners stop their ears and hold their tongues. The collection box was passed around with strict instructions to contribute to the poor heathens who were languishing in spicy lands like India, so ignorant that they had never heard of churchianity. Under the new dispensation, all of this has been changed. The inflowing cosmic light forces the closing of the circle very rapidly. An individual who sows discord may feel the effects in his own body within an hour or two. This is of tremendous advantage to the disciple, for when he feels discord around him or within his lower bodies, he can transmute it instantly by visually blazing violet fire through it. But the tools of darkness know nothing of these methods, and when their own discord closes around them they are helpless. In a short time disease grips them, and then death ensues. As soon as they shed their physical body they are removed to temples of the violet fire to undergo purification. This purification must be satisfactorily completed before they will be permitted to come back into embodiment. This cleansing process will sweep through the entire economic system on the planet in a very short time, because that is probably the most critical focus of remaining evil. Although war, churchianity, crime and sex are all foci of evil in themselves, they have virtually lost their individual identities, and have merged almost completely with the engulfing contamination of the root of evil. Money. The secret of abundant money has been lost by the race of man on this planet, because man has hidden it from himself in a place he would never remember in his searchings. The secret of money lies hidden in the law of gravity. In the very near future man will discover that the force of gravity can be safely utilized only if associated with levitation. The free energy spaceships now being built by Otis T. Carr of Baltimore do not get off the ground by fighting against gravity. Mr. Carr utilizes gravity to achieve the opposite effect. Levitation. In order for a man to levitate or a craft to levitate, it is not necessary to do anything about gravity. It is not necessary to challenge gravity. Gravity can be left right where it is, in its own negative force field. Any positive force field will naturally float away from it. Levitation is the exact opposite of precipitation in its effect. In principle they are the same. Whatever is being levitated goes up, whatever is being precipitated comes down, or is attracted into the gravitational force field. We can therefore precipitate abundance from the atmosphere. Or we can, under the law of the new dispensation, attract to ourselves any commodity such as money. As a race we have completely forgotten how to levitate at will, and yet at one time it was as simple for us as raising our hand. But since the time of Newton we have become quite gravity conscious. Therefore, it is relatively easy for us to learn to attract or precipitate. It is easy, that is, if we clearly recognize that we are dealing with physics, and not with metaphysics. Precipitation and etherealization, gravitation and levitation, belong strictly to the higher realm of pure science, and the individual who would use these powers successfully must be pure in heart. This protection is a great divine blessing bestowed upon the race. If the impure in heart could levitate machines, they would have landed rockets and warheads on the moon long ago. Abundance of wealth will come about naturally under law as the space age focuses the attention of the people on levitation of men and machines. Once levitation is accepted as possible, practical, and extremely desirable, the more familiar force of gravity will lose its hold upon the minds of men. The problem is in the mind, not in gravity itself. We must simply know and prove to ourselves that we can employ gravity at will, and that we can likewise levitate at will. The difficulty now is that we accept appearances. We see everyone around us walking on the earth by lifting only one foot at a time, so we unthinkingly do likewise. We see automobiles rolling along on four wheels and continue to manufacture them to operate in that clumsy, inefficient manner. If we wish to change these things, we must simply refuse to accept appearances. We must refocus the beam of our attention. Actually, it is much easier to lift 2 feet off the ground at the same time and levitate. It is easier to design an automobile to go over traffic, than to chug along, bumper to bumper, and swing in and out of traffic, mile after weary mile. In any case, it is necessary to change the attention first. The result will follow naturally. The change in our money system will come as soon as we take our attention away from the present diabolically engineered scheming, and follow natural, scientific methods of blessing money. That which is blessed grows and expands. As a race, we will unite in freeing money from the imprisoning thought forms no longer needed, thus releasing the atoms and returning them to the universal storehouse. The drastic change needed in our money system can be brought into manifestation with rapidity if we will thoughtfully focus our attention on the third book listed in this series, Progress and Poverty by Henry George. This economist was one of the great men among the spiritual giants who have appeared at opportune times upon the American scene. His science of political economy is solidly rooted in one certain aspect of the cosmic law governing the service required of elemental life held in manifested form. A form, whether it be a human body or skyscraper or automobile, should be held in manifestation only as long as it is being actively and creatively used. But a form such as a planet is not subject to man's control, and is held in manifestation as long as it is being used as a physical body by a planetary logos. All land and water on the surface of the planet therefore belong to the universal storehouse of manifested natural resources. Man sins against the land when he lays personal claim to it, holds it out of creative use, exploits it, or otherwise abuses it. Henry George presented a system which, if followed, would result in freeing all imprisoned and abused land and returning it to the global supply of natural resources. Under his system, anyone may borrow the use of land for any constructive purpose of production that will benefit mankind. But he states that private ownership of land must not be permitted to continue. It is an abuse which must be wiped out. In his philosophy, written before the turn of the century, he presents his reasons, in a calm, lucid manner. He always tried to be a politely reasonable man. He hoped to win his points with a gentle approach, for he could not bring himself to believe that humanity was actually in love with its own foulness. Yet at every turn he met with hostility and lack of acceptance. He was too valuable a man to waste on ingrates, so he was permitted to withdraw from embodiment, leaving his work for others to develop as a part of Saint Germain's program, until such a time as he may desire to again return to the physical plane to take up new age tasks. Today we can be more forthright in our protests against private ownership of land. Owning a piece of the physical body of the planetary logos, or a piece of land, is exactly the same as owning a piece of the aggregate physical body of mankind, or a captive slave. One is as bad as the other. The slaves have been extremely vocal about their situation and it has been alleviated in part. The good earth suffers in silence. But on the inner planes it is a silence which resounds like thunder. The storm is building up in intensity and will soon break over the usurious muddle which man pridefully calls his economic system. Jesus had something to say about usury 2,000 years ago. When he returns into outer activity as a world teacher, it is to be hoped he will not have to mention that subject. The least we can do for him is to clean up the mess ourselves. Usury and private ownership of land are virtually synonymous today, and both must go. Henry George knew all these things, for he carried over great memory sequences from a previous embodiment in Paris during the fateful years that preceded the French Revolution. At that time he was an active working disciple in the field of economics, although he served in another capacity at the court of Versailles. It was during those years that Saint-Germain tried to stem the tide of revolution in Europe and form the United States of Europe. At the same time he succeeded in establishing the United States of America, and it was his desire to have the entire Western world peacefully organized into states held together by a common bond of understanding. The plan of Saint-Germain for a United States of Europe still remains to be carried out, but it will be successfully finalized during the next century, together with similar groupings in Asia and the Orient. Thus it can be seen that Saint-Germain's United States of America is a pilot nation for the entire world. To understand the system of political economy toward which the world is trending at the moment, we can find significant guideposts scattered all through the writings of Henry George. Progress and Poverty is his outstanding book because of its tremendous heart quality. The quality is the because he carried over the formulated science of political economy acquired during his years at the court of Versailles. When he wrote Progress and Poverty in the United States, he was a lone worker, bringing forth cherished memories from the past. But in Paris he was part of a group of intellectuals, who were spiritually oriented to their task by Saint-Germain. Their mission was a dangerous one politically and stood more to fail than to succeed at that particular time. But the men and women in the Versailles group had seen so many civilizations rise and fall that they were not concerned about that aspect. Had they not had that kind of experience in previous embodiments, they would have been of no value to the group. The Versailles group did not accomplish all that had been planned, but the one main objective did succeed and stands unshaken today. The United States of America, under the firm guardianship of Uncle Sam. Saint-Germain was Samuel, the prophet, in a former embodiment, and in many incarnations had used that name. He therefore established the symbol of himself as Uncle Sam, so that the nation which grew up around that symbol could always enjoy the protection of his guardianship. France and America were firmly united in mutual assistance, for it was thought that when the new United States of America was launched, the French people would have the strength to lead Europe to its great destiny of unification. Russia was likewise to be included, and Saint-Germain was successful in placing Catherine the Great on the Russian throne. Had France continued on her path of destiny, Russia would likewise have succeeded. That plan was interrupted, but such interruptions are always temporary and hurtful only to those who refuse to follow a plan which will fit into the divine plan. For more than 150 years, most of the energy which France and Russia have expended on their outer world work has been misused. Now they will have to start over again, for destiny cannot be avoided. The Versailles group remained steadfast until the very end, hoping that Marie Antoinette would not succumb to the cloud of despair that hung over her. Saint-Germain was untiring in his efforts to help her, but the task which she had so graciously accepted in happier days was more than she could cope with emotionally when she heard the ugly sound of the rabble at the palace gates. Marie Antoinette became queen many years after the Versailles group had been organized during the reign of Louis XV, and she had never really grasped the vision of the original plan. It was the socially gifted Countess Jean du Barry who actually held the group together, both inside and outside the palace, and during both reigns, Louis XV and XVI. Countess du Barry had the good sense to turn every opportunity to advantage to further whatever projects she might be sponsoring at the moment. She possessed great personal beauty and charm of manner, plus an amazing ability to play any role demanded, and play it to perfection. Her consummate skill as an actress was so outstanding that she became historically identified as a courtesan, the role which she played year after year. She was always on stage, always in character, and always willing to change roles a dozen times a day if necessary. And it was indeed very necessary for those who expected to survive court intrigue, scandal, lies and general blackmail. Survival in itself was considered sufficient, and it required the gay courage of a person like Countess du Barry to accomplish anything beyond that. It was the Countess du Barry who successfully and secretly arranged for the cloistered meetings of the Versailles group in an upstairs room near her quarters in the palace. Over a period of many years, these roundtable sessions were held and detailed plans formulated for the new United States of Europe. Documents were drafted and redrafted, studied, discussed, and submitted for general approval. Downstairs in the palace reception rooms, Countess du Barry played her gayest of roles while the meetings were in progress.